Edgar Allan Poe has a very striking short story that mirrors in a very effective way the deeper part of our spiritual life and experience. It's a story about two brothers in a boat who get caught in an infamous maelstrom or whirlpool. And as this boat slowly begins to circle ever nearer the horrifying spout of this whirlpool, one of the brothers clings desperately to the rigging. The other finds himself suddenly with a very clear head and finds himself very carefully observing all the objects that are being gradually sucked into this whirlpool. And he finds himself studying their shapes and sizes, their forms and so on, and notices how some are sucked in quickly, and some slowly, and some even do not seem to be going down at all. And because of this clear study that he makes in this terrifying situation, he hits on a solution as to how to be saved from the whirlpool. And I won't go into the details of that, which don't concern us, but he finds the way, and the whirlpool, instead of sucking him down, eventually throws him up and out to safety. Our life is like a sea, and we can very easily get lost in it, and sadly, very often sucked down. Now, I'm going this evening to be using one or two mandalas for mirroring the structure and dynamics of spiritual life and development. The definition of the mandala that I rather like is the following. The mandala is an engine of change, releasing energy to the extent to which the individual using it and concentrating upon it is capable of identifying himself with it. Mandala is a simple geometric design, frequently used in the East from ancient times. Its equivalent in science is what is called a model. So in fact, I shall frequently refer to certain models this evening, because I was trained as a scientist. The deeper you go into science, the closer you find you're talking the same language in different words to that of the mystics from long ago. The particular mandala that I'm going to be focusing upon tonight, as you are aware from the programme, is that of the spiral. The spiral is a universal symbol, mandala, or model that runs from the modern awareness of the atom to that of galaxies, and it is to be found in the smallest atom of living matter, the DNA molecule, and it's to be found in the larger aspects of the human organism, in the muscle fibers of the body. So from small things to great, we find the spiral appearing as a kind of universal archetypal form. And of course, spirals occur in many cultures in their art forms of various interesting sorts. Now, I'm going to begin by referring to the essential geometry of the spiral. There are several sorts of spiral. Some are flat, some are in three dimensions, as that particular one on the board there. They all have reference to a centre. This centre will be a fixed centre if we are referring to a flat spiral, if you collapse that down into two dimensions. Or if it's in three dimensions, there is a centre which is moving in some way as you move around the spiral. In this case, the centre will move up if you are moving up the spiral, and the centre will move down if you are moving down the spiral. And in this particular case, it will define a vertical axis. Now, the cycles of a spiral may be expanding, you go down, they expand, or they may be contracting if you go up. And the way I have drawn this particular spiral or model is what I call the mountain mandala, which is picturing how in one sense we can see our path of life as being traversing around the mountain and hopefully ascending. And as we ascend higher, we find ourselves closer and closer to others who are also ascending the mountain. And it doesn't matter where you start from the bottom of the mountain, you get closer and closer as you rise higher. And the star at the top there, in this particular form, we can use to indicate the closeness we are to our divine origin. But we can also turn this upside down. If we turn it upside down, we've got Edgar Allan Poe's whirlpool. We've got a different image, again, able to represent aspects of our spiritual life. I call this sometimes the whirlpool mandala, sometimes the black hole mandala, because down here we now have a spiritual black hole which sucks the spirit downwards and inwards. Realize, of course, that as in physical science, models are not necessarily at all contradictory because they appear to be different. There's no reason why our life shouldn't be mirrored with the spiral that way up and also with the spiral the other way up, or mirrored by other kinds of spiral. For instance, the torus. If you imagine a donut ring, imagine a point going around and around and around, always going through the hole in the middle and returning out again. Swedenborg had a particular form of torus with a polar tunnel, a little bit more complicated than that, in which he imagined the particles rotating in some form of elementary atom. That particular form has been taken up in theosophical circles, and some of you may have seen sometimes this particular form of a spiral which is constantly going down through a polar tunnel and coming out again at the other side. Swedenborg published his model in 1733. But now let's examine a little more the mountain model. We have here the easier natural way of ascent, where you gradually go round and round, and it's never particularly steep at any point. Every time you go round, it's a cycle of experience. And of course, when you're on one side of the mountain, you can't see the other side, and you can't see people who are on the other side. So you may think that they're not there, or that they're going somewhere else. But the higher you go up the spiral, the closer you get to this divine source. But I'm not going to concentrate on this particular model tonight, because I've become so aware from my own experience that as my spirit is gradually caused to ascend through experiences in life, my sense of life is one of expansion and not of contraction. So that to think of expanding as one goes up, at the moment, fits my own experience better. Now, I want to add a little more detail for us in this particular model. I want you to think of everything which is inside the dotted lines as being that which is within the awareness our spirit, and everything which is outside is that which our spirit is quite unable to be aware of. Or to put another way round, what is inside is that in which we feel there is life for us, it's alive in some way, Anything which is outside of this cone, we feel is dead or lifeless. Now, every point in this model space, every point contains the whole infinity of the divine. This is a picture that Swedenborg gives us so very clearly himself, working in the 1720s and 30s, speculating upon the origin of the physical universe, that it is applied also to the spiritual universe, the world that our spirits inhabit as well. You realize that within every single atom of matter, there must be infinite energy which clothes itself by moving into less and less dynamic forms, slower and slower movements of particles, until one ends up with the static atom. But I want us to think spiritually and not physically. And I want us to think of every point in this three-dimensional space as essentially containing the whole of the infinity of the divine. So that if we are at the moment traversing a particular circle on the spiral, all the points within the area demarcated represent all that part of our life where we feel there is something really alive about it. Whereas outside, no, it's something dead. Every point, therefore, in this space shares the same divine. And that's why we can talk about how all this space is really one. It doesn't matter what part of it you take. At the heart of it is the same divine. And therefore, from a deeper way of looking at this space, it is all one, although there may be many different forms that we see within it. Now the centre point on this axis, in this particular whirlpool, or gusher, or black hole model, the centre point represents the divine, or life, as it is centred in me. I want us to think of the centre here as being me, whoever me is. In this case, I'm thinking of myself, my little ego. So that we can use this model in this way and see that if we are to traverse the spiral in a downwards direction, we are heading towards a point where there is nothing in my world but me. I'm the only living divine thing in my world. I have made myself God, and only I am God. Now that is the black hole of total self-centeredness, which excludes life and meaning and purpose and importance from everything else except what I want and what I need and what is important for me. So down here we could write the word hell. We have an image of hell in our spiritual space. And up here we could write heaven, or the infinite, or the universal divine, and so on. If you go down, it's what we call a vicious circle. And how often we do talk in everyday life about being caught in vicious circles. And you will know from your experience how vicious they so frequently are. They really do suck you down with fears and jealousies and worries and self-pity, and you feel that you can't get out unless somebody miraculously pulls you out and gives you what you want. But there is a non-vicious circle, or a set of non-vicious circles in life. There is a way of moving upwards the spiral which is not vicious, but which takes one more and more into true life and living. I'd like at this point to actually quote to you one or two things that Swedenborg wrote in the 18th century in connection with this mandala of the spiral. Swedenborg, by the way, was given a most wonderful and marvellous experience of the whole spiritual world, being able to meet with spirit directly, those who had passed beyond the veil of the flesh, and was given wonderful images to help understand how this spiritual world actually operates, what its spiritual laws are. And he writes this. This is to do with the structure of the human mind, which is essentially spiritual and exists in the spiritual dimension. There are changes and variations in the organic forms of the mind, which are the subjects of man's affections and thoughts, which are vortex-like inward and outward gyrations, after the manner of perpetually circling spirals, wonderfully combined into forms receptive of life. In those who are good, these spiral forms are moved forwards, but in the wicked, backwards. And those that are moved forward are turned toward the Lord and receive influx from him, while those that are moved backward are turned towards hell and receive influx from hell. The state of the natural mind before it is reformed can be compared to a spiral twisting or bending itself downwards, but after reformation it can be compared to a spiral twisting or bending itself upwards. The natural mind, with all its belongings, is bent back into gyres from right to left. But the spiritual mind is bent into gyres that move from left to right. The gyration from right to left is turned downwards, thus towards hell, but the gyration from left to right is turned upwards, thus towards heaven. And then he goes on to make this very interesting observation. An evil spirit can gyrate his body only from right to left, and not from left to right, while a good spirit can gyrate his body from right to left only with difficulty, but with ease from left to right. The gyration follows the flow of the mind's interiors. Perhaps when you go home, you can have a go at seeing whether you are happier rotating a clockwise direction, which is the good one, according to Swedenborg, or whether it comes easier to you to rotate in the anti-clockwise direction. I hope you have a good result from that. I tried it, and it worked all right for me, so I hope it does for you too. Right, now we're going to look at a horizontal cross section of this spiral, which of course will be in circular form. So we're just looking at it in two dimensions now, and we now have the circular pattern of our life, when we have the feeling that we're going round and round in circles. In this diagram, I have divided the two parts, a dark part and a light part, because sometimes we seem to move in an area of life where there is love and light in our life. And then we lose this and we go into an area which is dark, and our fears come to the surface and we are subject to illusions. But I'd like to perhaps just make this point clear at this moment, that people, when they are very unaware of what is going on inside them in life, are frequently unaware of how much darkness there is. They're not aware of how much their life is driven by fears and how much they are under illusions. So in traversing from the area of light into darkness, I want you to realize that this is representing when we come into a state where we recognize we're moving into darkness, where we recognize fears that are dominating our lives, where we discover illusions that we've been under. So So it's a recognition of darkness that the upper half of the circle represents. Now, rather more interesting, slightly more complex mandala for that is the ancient Chinese Taoist yin yang symbol. Again, we have the circle, but now it has been divided in this particular way so that it can represent how the lighter part of our life, which is called yang in Chinese, starts from something small and then gradually increases to a zenith point, and then the yin phase takes over and starts and increases until it reaches, you can call it a nadir point. And this particular cycle is mirrored for us all the time in nature by the revolution of the earth around its axis and the earth around the sun. So the first one gives us a revolution which gives us morning light, greater light at noon, a fading of the light in the evening, and a lot of light at night. And this cycle in nature is a perfect mirror for what goes on inside the spirit, although until we become spiritually aware and able to look into ourselves, we may not realize this at all. So that's what happens to light. Light increases, waxes, and then it wanes. And we have the same thing happening for love or heat with the seasons, where we get warmth returning in the spring, reaching a maximum in the summer, waning in the autumn, and going back into a cold phase at night. And the Chinese put these little circles in here to represent the experience that we become aware of as we become more spiritually aware, that the seeds of the next dark yin phase are already present and about to emerge when our light yang phase is approaching its maximum. And what is particularly important for us experientially, the beginnings of the next light or yin phase are already there and can be found by the spiritually aware when we reach the nadir of a current dark phase or dark night of the soul that we may be going through at the time. Now, why do we have both light and dark, heat and cold in life? This is the way Swedenborg expresses it. He says that no one knows what good is unless he also knows what non-good is. Nor does he really know what truth is unless he knows what non-truth is. How can you evaluate lightness unless you have some darkness? What's the good of a photograph which is nothing but lightness all over? The quality of good, Swedenborg says, is known through opposition from evil. It's the experience of evil in our life that enables us to become aware of what goodness really is. And if we turn to the Bible, we have expressions such as this in Isaiah, where God declares, "I form the light and I create darkness." And the prophet Jeremiah declares, "Give glory to the Lord your God before he brings the darkness, before your feet stumble on the darkening hills." And the psalmist declares this to God, "You bring darkness, it becomes night, and all the beasts of the forest prowl." That means that when we enter a dark night of the soul, we become aware of some very negative, bad feelings inside us. These are the inner beasts that emerge out of the subconscious, out of the sea, as has been so powerfully pictured in some of the prophets and in the book of Revelation. We can go further and see that the yin and the yang in life are actually the basis of man's free will or choice and responsibility. If our life was all light and love, we would have no choice. We would simply be acting out the impulses of our Creator. We would be his puppets on string. But we are in a position where, in a state of light and love, we can turn to darkness. When we are in the darkness and the cold, we can turn to light and love. And we become aware of our fundamental inner ability to make a choice, and therefore to be responsible for the choices we make in our life. Now let's look at a vertical cross-section of our whirlpool mandala. And I call this the ladder of ascent. So this is taking a cut down, vertically down the middle of the spiral. So we now have a zigzag line that is alternately moving through the light into the darkness, back into the light again. And each time a cycle is gone through, another run of the ladder is climbed if we are going around the spiral in a clockwise direction. From left, which is the sinister, in the Latin term, to the right, which is the dexter. And according to this model, we can clearly see that spiritual ascent takes place in discrete steps. You don't slide your way upwards to heaven and to God. The only way to climb from one rung to the next is to first of all be called to descend into a dark area, and then when you come out you find that you have gone up one rung of the ladder of ascent. I put a little dot here, a light dot there, to indicate that the light of the next phase is starting already at the nadir, and the seed of the next yin or dark phase is present at the zenith of the light phase. This shows us that rebirth takes place in the darkness, in a state of spiritual darkness, awareness of spiritual darkness. This recalls for us how Christ was born in the night of a bleak midwinter, as the start of a new cycle of spirituality for mankind. The same is true for the New Age, which is now dawning. The New Age was born in the 18th century, in the midst of intellectual coldness and darkness. There's an interesting quote I can give you here from Swedenborg, who refers to this need for incessant rebirth as being like going into a chrysalis or an egg. He says that, and he's speaking here spiritually, although it also applies psychologically when we start from infancy. But he's referring to when our spirit moves from an infant state, its beginning state, towards a more mature state. And he says that the age of infancy is like an egg to the state of childhood, and the stage of childhood is like an egg to the stage of adolescence and youth, and this is like an egg to adult stage, so that a man is, as it were, continually being reborn. When a man is born again, he passes through similar stages to one who is born, and the state which precedes is always like an egg, that's the dark phase, the shut-in phase, relative to the state that follows. Thus he is being conceived and born continually, and this naturally when living in the world, but also to eternity when he comes into the other life. And yet he can never be perfected further than to be like an egg, relatively to the things that still remain, which are without limit. Now, if this model is an accurate representation of our experience, and if the Bible is a revelation of timeless, eternal truth, then the Bible should reveal this spiral pattern or ladder of ascent, and it should fill in and enlarge our understanding of our spiritual development through many parable mirrors. The stories and events in the Bible should be picking out these high light events and these low dark events, and showing how each one has a different character in our own experience of them as we go through them. And this indeed turns out to be the case. Each turn of the spiral in the biblical mirror reveals a different facet of the progressive yin and yang phases of our spiritual growth. And I want to refer us to some of those now. If we think, to begin with, of Adam and Eve in the garden, we have here a picture on the right side, and Adam and Eve in the garden picture for us how safe it seems when we feel we are surrounded and protected by the love of God and provided with all good things to eat. We lack nothing. So this mirrors those yang phases of our life where we feel safe and protected by the Lord's love and provided with everything we need. Thus Adam and Eve fall and are expelled from the garden, and so we come into a yin phase where we feel shut out in some way from life, and we find that we have to toil and sweat to do anything good, to have any bread to eat. Later on we go through a flood experience and we begin to feel in another yin phase that so much of our selfishness is swamping our life. It's a flood of waters, and we need to find refuge in an ark where we can find God, but in a very enclosed, tiny space within us, until it is time when the flood waters can recede and we can come safely out and walk again across a beautiful land. When that happens, Noah sees a rainbow in the sky. A rainbow, this wonderful symbol of the covenant that God makes with man. And I'm sure you all know that you can only see a rainbow in its beautiful colours against a dark, cloudy background. It is an image of the light of God's truth seen in a state, or set against a state, where we feel we are in darkness. Later on, we find the children of Israel multiplying and becoming a great people in Egypt. And we see here a yang phase where we begin to absorb knowledge of truth very rapidly. You've probably all experienced times when you've been able to read spiritual books and take in lots of spiritual understanding. Your knowledge grows and grows and grows. According to the biblical mirror, a point comes where we begin to feel that we are in bondage. In this case, we're becoming trapped by intellectual knowledge, and that somehow we are missing out on the real thing in life, and we begin to labour and toil again. We become slaves to spiritual knowledge, and the more spiritual knowledge we get, the less it seems to save us from what is holding us bound. And so, of course, according to the biblical story, the release point comes and we're able to move out, but we don't move straight into the promised land. The children of Israel are led around and around, all over the place, frequently through areas of great wilderness, the yin parts of the cycles. Eventually, we find the children of Israel getting to the border of the promised land. They come to the River Jordan, and they are blocked by the River Jordan itself, they are also blocked by great cities like Jericho with huge walls and strong men inside. How many times, when we're becoming more spiritually aware, do we discover spiritual blocks and barriers in our life, and we're afraid and we cower behind these barriers, unable to move forward? The children of Israel, with God's help, eventually enter into the promised land, and they have a precarious foothold in certain highland areas, but they are surrounded by the original inhabitants, who unmercifully plunder their goods and take them into slavery from time to time. Always happening, we're told, when the Israelites forget their God and go after other gods, what we would call the gods of materialism or other dangerous false deities. And we read in the book of Judges how this cycle kept being repeated again and again and again. For a while, the people would turn to Jehovah and worship him, and all would go well. Then they would succumb to the people around them and their ways, and their goods would be plundered, and they would be taken into bondage. They would cry out to the Lord, and the Lord would raise up a saviour called a judge, and the judge would save them from the enemy. And then they would worship God for a period until the cycle starts all over again. But sadly, at the end of the book of Judges, we find it said that every man was doing what was right in his own eyes, and we have a picture of a state of anarchy. This mirrors those states in our own life when we are wavering. Should I follow this impulse or that impulse? Is it this thought which is good and true, or that thought? And our conscience is vacillating from one thing to another. We're thinking and doing one thing one minute and something else the next. Well, the story goes on, but my time is limited, but we could traverse the whole of the Bible and draw out different facets of this ascending spiral, ending eventually with the wonderful image of the descent of the Holy City, which is the Bride of the Lamb, which is an image of that final union which the created spirit is to make with its creator, to become the bride of the lover of God. Now let's look at some other general points concerning the dark or yin states. From our experience, one of the things that we can become aware of about these states in our life is that these are, in a way, like spaces that God leaves us, where we can experience being apparently alone and without him. We like children, you see, and because of these spaces, it's like Mummy and Daddy saying to the child, you can go out and play on your own for a bit now and do what you want. And we get experience of what it's like to be trying to grow up without having our heavenly parents breathing down our shoulder all the time. So although these states are not pleasant states in themselves, one of the wonderful aspects of them is that it is our Heavenly Father giving us space to see what we will choose to do when we've got the freedom to follow our own principles. Many of you may be familiar with the beautiful story. I don't think we know the author of this story. The story of the footsteps in the sand on the beach. The story is told of the man whose life, the events in his life, were mapped out, as it were, by his footsteps left leaving an imprint in the sand on the beach, and how a lot of the time he would see that there were two sets of footprints side by side. The other prints he knew were those of his Heavenly Father, of God. But at the end of his life, as he's looking back, he sees that there are so many gaps where there's only one set of footprints. And as he comes home to his Heavenly Father, he says to his Father, "Father, why did you leave me so often in life? So often there were only my footprints there." And his Father replies to him, "Son, those were the times when I was carrying you." The way in which Swedenborg describes the same situation of how we appear to be left bereft in the dark, he calls these states of temptation combat, where we have to face the darker side in our own nature. And he says from his own spiritual experience that in those states, God is closer to his child than at any other time. Another point we should realise is that this darkness, represented by this yin part of the cycle, is not to be confused with the black hole at the bottom of the whirlpool. The black hole at the bottom of the whirlpool is simply where I shrink my life till there's nothing but me and my wants. But this darkness is different. It is when our soul within can see that there is darkness around us. Whereas in the black hole, you can't see the darkness, you can't see anything but self, self, self. Another facet that comes out of our experience is that as we get used to this rhythm of going into the darkness, or being taken into the darkness from time to time, we begin to learn how to take something of the warmth and light that we have gained on this side with us into the dark. So that even though the storm may be raging about us, we've lost our job, we've lost our loved ones, people are leaving us, and so on, we know where we can find the light and love of God deep within us. And so we take life and love with us to protect us in these darker states. This is as we learn the rhythm of our spiritual life and how to handle it to our own and everyone around us best advantage. As the psalmist declares, "There arises light in darkness." Another point we can draw from this model is that as we ascend the ladder of ascent, so the area of the circle gets wider. And as I said at the beginning, this represents how we become more aware of life in a broader way. But the area of darkness is getting greater also. What does that tell us? It tells us that we are getting more sensitive to darkness in life. You can't see darkness unless you have a point of light within you in which to see it. Otherwise you call the darkness light and the light darkness. So the growing area of darkness is actually an indication of the fact that there is really at bottom greater light within us. Also, as we ascend the spiral, we learn or receive by experience an ever truer humility. Those who endeavour to ascend the ladder directly, and there have been a number, they attempt something very dangerous, often with bad results. The trouble with endeavouring to go straight up this Tower of Babel, as you can call it if you try to build it straight up to God, is that you walk straight into what the Greeks called hubris, that is pride, arrogance, and the cold shouldering of God. This is mirrored so clearly in the Pharisee image in the Gospels. If you feel that you can climb directly up to God, you will find that you are becoming self-proud, and you begin to feel you don't need God anymore, as the Pharisees felt. That is the danger of that way. But if you go the proper way, through the cycles of darkness, each one humbles you and brings you into a true childlike relationship and dependence upon your Heavenly Father. The prophet Khalil Gibran makes this very beautiful point, that the deeper that sorrow carves into your being, the more joy you can contain. In these darker states, we experience pain and sorrow. If we can only come to realize that this pain and sorrow is like the knife of God carving a deeper well in us, so that we can hold a deeper joy and experience it. The deeper that sorrow carves into your being, the more joy you can contain. But overall, as we ascend the spiral, we are in fact like a lotus flower that is beginning to open out and to blossom, or a lily, like the lilies of the field that Christ speaks of. See your ascent of this spiral as being like the beautiful flower of your spirit beginning to open out and to blossom, to unfold in an ever-increasing number of petals and contrasting hues and shades. And I'd like to end again with a quotation from Gibran. The soul walks not upon a line, neither does it grow like a reed. The soul unfolds itself like a lotus of countless petals.